Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 25th, 1999. In the Koinonia Creekside room this morning are Bob and Gracie Ekblad. The session number is 99-9. The session title this morning is Liberation and Change in Central America, Confronting Poverty Through Sustainable Agriculture, Preventative Health Education, and Bible Study. Let's listen in.
All right, well, this session is entitled Confronting Poverty Through Sustainable Agriculture, Preventative Health Education, and Bible Study. And actually, I think it's Liberation in Central America. So today we have myself, Bob Ekblad, and then Celio Mejia, and David Calis, and Rocio Robles here. And what we want to do is sort of present the ministry of Tierra Nueva down in Honduras. And then we have, we want to talk more specifically about what are the forces of oppression that need to be addressed directly, you know, and how Tierra Nueva is trying to do that. Okay, so then we'd like to open it up for discussion. Estoy diciendo que vamos a tirar las fotos y después hablar un poco de las cosas que oprime a la gente y cómo podemos promover una liberación. Anyway, about in 1981, my wife Gracie and I, we went down to Honduras, or down to Guatemala actually. We were in language school. And it was there that we decided we wanted to work somewhere, you know, in Central America somehow with the poor, addressing some of the root causes of poverty. And we both, I was a history major from Seattle Pacific, and Gracie literature, so we didn't have any technical skills, and we didn't grow up in, you know, in the farm country. We grew up on Mercer Island, a suburb of Seattle, right? So about the extent of our farming was like spreading beauty bark around rhododendrons and edging lawns. But we were both emergency medical technicians, and we thought, well, maybe we can use our skills in some way teaching preventative health education. And we actually had a job lined up. We had our Guatemalan language teacher, Guatemalan Indian woman, Catalina Toc. She had, we'd met her in Guatemala, and the situation in Guatemala was horrible, a civil war going on there. And people couldn't do work of any kind, I mean development work, at that time. Anyway, Catalina had decided she wanted to work with us, and we'd gotten accepted by the Mennonite Central Committee to work as border monitors along the Salvador and Honduran border. So we, but we wanted to work doing sustainable development somewhere, but we figured we'd do that job if we couldn't find anything else. So anyway, we ended up traveling all through Central America looking for a place to work with the support of this church that just, actually this member of this church had discovered he had $100,000 worth of Wang computer stock. Mm-hmm. And he'd given the money to this little community, little academic community, kind of Christian community in Southern Oregon, and said, I think you guys should start a mission committee. You know, or you know, have maybe we should try to support someone, and that was right when we'd come back from Central America looking for someone to support. And so they said, well, we'll support you. Mm. And so that was the seed money for this little Christian community to send us down. So we went traveling through Central America looking for a place to work, couldn't find anything, so we ended up with the Mennonite Central Committee on the border. But our first contact was a Guatemalan doctor, and he was missing when we got there. And a couple days later, they found his body. He'd been killed by the Honduran army. So MCC and United Nations, we were working with the UN as, you know, on the border through MCC. They said, oh, the Guatemalan woman can't work with you guys. So that got us, you know, thinking about looking for other alternatives. And we found this group, a man actually named Jose Elias Sanchez in Honduras. He had a Honduran development agency. And he said, if you guys want to work addressing, if you want to work helping address the root causes of poverty, forget about preventative health education. He says, our main problem is lack of production. So you have to work in agriculture, otherwise you're just wasting your time. I mean, this guy was pretty dogmatic. And we said, well, we can't work in agriculture. And he says, well, yes, you can. I know a Honduran peasant guy who will work with you guys probably. Let's go visit him. You know, he's a master organic intensive farmer. And his name is Don Fernando, so let's go. So we said, wow, that's a great idea. So we went out and visited this guy out in this field, and Elias said, hey, Fernando, how would you like to go work with these gringos, you know? And start this demonstration farm out in the middle of the country. And so Fernando said, well, okay, you know, I'll try it for 3 months. And Elias told us, yes, he said he'll work for you for at least a year, maybe three. So Elias, he took us out shopping. We got pick shovels and hoes and seeds and hoses, and we were so excited, you know. This was like the total romantic move to the country, right, for us. And it was kind of the ideal situation. Because we've been reading a lot of liberation theology and were really impacted by this idea that people from the north, you know, and from developed countries who are educated, and white folks like ourselves, that the best posture we should take is one of learners and as servants. And if we can come down and learn from the people themselves, and you know, that's a way to sort of turn things upside down, right? And so this was all happening right before our eyes. I mean, we were invited by this guy. He said, I'll get you your residencies. Here's the Honduran peasant who's going to teach you everything, and you guys can work together. And so, you know, we were psyched. We moved into this farm. This is actually our second farm. And this was the beginnings of Tierra Nueva. Estoy explicando todo como encontramos José Elias Sánchez y Don Fernando y todo. So anyway, what we did is we farmed a steep piece of land. It was a worthless plot. We chose, you know, the kind of the worst plot in town. And Fernando assured us that he could turn that land into just a beautiful, organic kind of demonstration plot. And we began farming, you know, with picks and shovels and oxen, just using all the same tools and technologies that the people used. The only difference was that we didn't burn. I mean, the major difference is we didn't burn, and we climbed into the curve of the land, and you'll see as we get going in the pictures. The objective was to try to develop a sustainable agricultural system that would allow people to survive on minimal land, you know, I mean, and marginal land. You know, and the most of the Honduran people that have land at all have steep land that most agronomists would say is totally useless for agriculture, right? So anyway, we moved into this. Our first farm was different than this. We lived in a different farm for 2 years. It was just a beautiful spot, you know, right on the road and the trail system where all the peasants would pass through. This is also on the trail system, but our first farm, a big Italian multinational lumber company came in and deforested all the mountains all the way around our farm and destroyed our water source. So we had to move and start another plot. And this farm was called La Marihuana. You know, the marijuana. So we were los gringuitos de la marihuana. So we tried to live as simply as we could, and we were really into downward mobility to the extreme. I mean, you know, we didn't have any transportation. If we hitchhiked everywhere we went and walked, and then we decided we'd get horses and mules. So we traveled on horseback and on muleback. And I was 23, Gracie was 21. We'd been married a year. And we cooked with wood and did all of our own washing and, you know, and tried to live just like the people as much as we could, until we realized that if we kept going in that direction, we'd die. You know, because the average Honduran peasant, you know, has amoebic dysentery and you know, and lice and fleas and, you know, and severe athlete's foot, and lives on a diet of just beans and rice, you know, and small amounts of it, and works long hours under the hot sun. And boy, I mean, we got amoebic dysentery and it practically killed us, you know. And so we realized that we were kind of we were hybrids, you know. These guys were like the survival of the fittest functions in Central America. I mean, these guys are strong because they have brothers and sisters that have died of dysentery, but they've made it. And we, you know, we haven't been exposed to all that. So we were weak and we realized we had other needs. But anyway, Fernando was our teacher. And he, at first, wanted us, he wouldn't teach us anything. He said, you guys know everything. You know, you're gringos, you're educated, you know everything. And we'd have to say, no, Fernando, we don't know anything. Said, no, you know everything. And we'd say, what should we do? And he'd say, what should we do? You know, and pretty soon, after we destroyed one of his machetes on the rocks, you know, because we didn't know how to use the tools, you know, he got to realize that, you know, that he had to teach us. This was our second farm, and you know, the demonstration farm really allowed people to see that, you know, that erosion. I mean, you know, the water can be controlled. Like this was from our deck of our second house, and you can see that there's pouring rain, and the rain's staying in the rows, right? But we had hundreds of people that would stop by our farm, and sometimes they get caught in rainstorms, and they could see that our land wasn't eroding away because we were planting to the curve of the land in terraces. And that led to just an incredible harvest. Our first year, for every pound of beans we planted, we harvested 100 pounds. In our second year, for every pound, we harvested 200 pounds. And the average Honduran peasant would plant 108 pounds of seed and maybe harvest 80 pounds or 100 pounds. And a lot of them were getting just like 30 pounds. For 8 pounds of seed, they get 30 pounds. So, you know, we were able to demonstrate that on a very small plot of land, farming intensively, you could get all of your needs of beans, you know, met. So the same way with corn and potatoes and vegetables. And, you know, it shocked us, and it shocked all the people even more because they assumed that we were bringing hybrid seeds from the United States. We had to show them, no, these seeds we bought from Don Porfirio's, you know, the same place you guys buy your seeds. So this led to a class that we organized, which was called Appropriate Technology for the Use and Management of Steeply Inclined Land. Tecnología apropiada para el uso y manejo de tierras en maderas. And our first year we had 12 farmers that took the course, and each of those farmers were successful, you know, in the same way that we were. And then the second year we had 65 farmers, and third year 200, and fourth year 1,000. And that's how these guys came into the program, which we'll get into later. The course was mainly practical, but we did always do a theoretical part. But most of it was, we talk about how our pens are the picks, and our paper is the land, and that we're going to go out and write on the land with our picks and shovels, and that you don't have to be an educated person, you don't have to be literate. You know, that the whole idea was to, you know, to get out and actually do this work and to learn about it through doing. And in fact, the philosophy of the program is practice, you know, put into practice what you preach. I mean, you know, do it first yourself, right? So that involved, what we do is we encourage people that wanted to farm with us to put it into practice on a small corner of their land with these new methods. And they'd all say, oh, we want to turn our whole land. And we say, no, start small, because then you'll do a good job on something small and there'll be minimal risks. If, you know, maybe we're all wrong. Maybe we do have hybrid seeds. We're tricking you guys. You got to be convinced for yourself by trying it on a small plot. So we go out with a whole group of farmers of 12, and we go from field to field, marking out ditches and digging the ditches with the people, you know, which would form the basis of a terracing system. See, the ditch, once it's in, you know, you have to have some way to keep all the dirt from above the ditch to filling in the ditch, right? So we plant pasture grass or build rock walls, barreras vivas y muertas. And then this picture, the next picture is 3 months, I don't know, about 2 months after this picture.
Wow.
This guy had completely abandoned this plot and had this old dying mule kind of living on its last days on it, on this yellow grass, eating this yellow grass. And like a lot of the Honduran people, they've abandoned the land that's close to their field, close to their homes, because it's the land that it was easiest to farm. And because of slash and burn farming practices, you know, where, I mean, the land's completely eroded and sterile. And so this allowed people to go back and reclaim land that was close to their home, you know, and get bumper crops of corn and beans. It also allowed people to sink in the plow deeper so that they could, there was maximum absorption of rainwater and oxygen and everything else. This is David's brother, Jorge, with what we did is we realized, we first taught composting. You know, and that was our big thing. I gave hundreds and hundreds of courses on making, you know, these huge 3 foot or 3 meter square compost piles. You know, I mean, I was just going crazy. I got so sick of doing compost classes. It was just, that's all I did for the first couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then we realized that cover crops were really the way to go. And we began introducing this velvet bean, which covered the land and, would cover people's corn. And then, you know, they have to harvest their corn. It was a lot harder to harvest their corn, but then the cover crop would stay over the top of the crop, over the top of the corn, and over the land until the next season, dry season. And then all that could be chopped up with a machete and plowed under, and the whole land would be turned into a giant compost pile. Mm-hmm. So that allowed people to rebuild their soil very quickly. And so land that was abandoned and, you know, was being reclaimed left and right, and very steep land too. And people were getting better crops, better yields off of steep land than all the other folks that had the flat land. You know, some of the wealthier farmers that were just, you know, using chemical fertilizers or not using anything. When we first asked people why they thought they were poor, and we talked about this yesterday, but people would say, well, we're poor, you know, we've tried everything, we don't know why we're poor, it must be God's will. Es la voluntad de Dios. Somos pobres porque es la voluntad de Dios. But after after people began to farm using these methods, suddenly they were seeing that poverty was rooted in, it was because of erosion. You know, one of the reasons that they were poor was their land was eroding away, and another reason was that, you know, they weren't rebuilding their soil through composting. Another reason was they weren't spacing, the distancing between rows and between plants was too close. And another reason was no one had ever come to teach them any alternative farming practices. So there were all these reasons. And so when people began to learn how to think critically based on their experience on the farm, suddenly God was off the hook. You know? And this is one of the main ways that people were able to find liberation from, you know, this traditional way of blaming God in a way, you know, just seeing everything as being God's will, was to learn how to become critical thinkers. And suddenly there was a new opportunity for envisioning God, too. If it wasn't God's fault, then where was God? You know, and a typical sort of Marxist, you know, like guerrilla leader would probably say, well, see, we proved that God doesn't exist. It's all, you know, I mean, you know, Feuerbach, the secret of the of incarnation is, I mean, what is it he says? The secret of the incarnation is, or the mystery of the incarnation is, you know, is humanism or something. I mean, you know, everything is up to us. It's like it's a total horizontal plane, and if we're going to bring about liberation, you know, don't wait for God to do anything. It's up to us. You know? And we could have gone in that direction, right? But we didn't. So people were able to get bumper crops off of minimal land, and that was the first sort of sign of liberation for people, was increased production. And people who had, you know, one of the things that we saw was people's self-esteem grew. I mean, there was a tremendous change in people's view of themselves. The average farmer in Honduras, in Central America, feels terrible about themselves. You know, the rich and, you know, the upper class people say, oh, you know, the problem in our country is that the poor are just stupid and lazy. And they don't know how to farm. They're just burning up all the fields. And, you know, and the ecological movement has fed into that. They've said, look, you know, the biggest enemy of ecological preservation or whatever are the campesinos, the peasants, who are burning all the fields and deforesting the mountainsides, looking for firewood. You know, and the peasants have internalized that. And most campesinos feel very bad about themselves. So when suddenly they're able to get bumper crops off of steep, marginal land, it's like their whole image of themselves changes. La gente cambia su imagen de sí mismo, ¿verdad? Cuando uno tiene éxito, pues no es como, ¿verdad? Cuando uno está fracasando. Yeah, that'd be great. Another thing is that this guy was known as the local chicken thief, and everyone hated him because he was always robbing chickens from everybody. And when we started to work with him, he didn't have any land. And a guy came around. One of my professors, a physics prof from Seattle Pacific, one day he wrote me and said, hey, I got $500 that I want to donate to some special project. And right around that time, this guy came running to my house and he said, hey, there's a piece of land for sale right above my house. You know, I want to try these methods out, but I don't have any land. So we ended up starting this project, where a rotating fund where we helped farmers that didn't have land buy land. And this guy put all these methods into practice on this land and just had this incredible yield. Mm-hmm. You know, and people were mad at us for helping him. They said, yeah. You don't want to help this guy. He's a chicken thief. He should be punished, you know. And you're helping him. You're giving him land. And we'd say, well, if you want him to just keep stealing chickens, the best thing to do is just to abandon him and, you know, cast him off and reject him. But if you want to help him, help his children, I mean, why not? This is the best thing for him, you know. Mm-hmm.
¿Verdad que Julián era visto como un que robaba gallinas?
Como una oveja negra.
Yeah, he said he was the black sheep, this Julián guy.
Okay, you can pass. I hate this picture.
Anyway, Gracie began to visit the wives of the men that I worked with, you know, around the same time that the men began visiting us. But this was a harder job because a lot of the men didn't want their wives to participate in any kind of classes. There was distrust, and so that meant going door to door, you know, house to house, and establishing relationships with women. And this took time, you know, a lot more time. It was much harder, and the women were much busier, you know, too. You know, they were always, you know, the average family, maybe five kids, six kids, and, you know, with little kids and having to go and wash in the river and, you know, and cook everything from scratch. I mean, you know, people were submerged. You know, women were submerged.
little by little,
we were able to, you know, Grace was able to organize women's groups. And then as we gained the trust of the communities, we'd get whole communities that would come to our courses. Mm-hmm. We'd give these, after about our fourth year in Honduras, we had courses that we called Como Cuidar a Su Pueblo, How to Care for Your Village. And we have these 5-day classes where the whole village would show up sometimes. You know, we have, this was Huachipilín Todo Pueblo Venía Pues. We had, this was a class on soybeans where we would be, one day we would go out with the men and we'd teach planting soybeans. And where, while Gracie was with the women and children, teaching how to make soy milk and other soy products. And then we calculated it so that we'd come back with the men right when the soy bread was coming out of the oven. Uh-huh. And, you know, we sit around and drink coffee and have soy bread before we have a Bible study. And you know, then we pass out seeds, and that was the way that soybeans were promoted, you know, throughout our region. So bean production, mainly black beans, red beans, and the corn production, that was what drew people into our program. And we didn't even talk about God or that we had any kind of religious motivation. In fact, we weren't really trained to, you know, pastorally. We were trained in history and literature, right? We did want to get involved in theological reflection with people, and we're really excited about that. But we were bending over backwards to not impose anything religious on people. And we decided at the beginning to not go to any church either, because we didn't want anyone to feel excluded, because we were going to a church that maybe excluded them. You know, if we were with Protestant churches, we figured that a lot of the Catholics would think we were evangelicals and they would just trust us, which they would have. And if we went to Catholic churches, then the evangelicals would reject us. So we just didn't go anywhere. We had our own little Bible study in our home, out on our farm. Another thing that we got involved in was helping, and we organized a place called the La Universidad del Campo, the University of the Countryside, where we had courses that were like permanently, I mean, going on all the time on everything from how to make grain storage silos to, you know, how to do conflict resolution classes. We had some of the top people from Mennonite, you know, Mennonite Central Committee who were conflict resolution specialists who were working in Central America. And it was in the 80s, you know, when all the wars were going on. They came and gave us week-long seminars on conflict resolution. We had courses on how to read and study the scriptures, on human rights, you know, and what were the human rights, the basic human rights of the campesinos, and on how to think critically, you know, problem solving, and alphabetization, you know, teaching reading and writing, and preventative health education, how to cooking classes. I mean, all kinds of things. We had courses that were just constantly going on. And one of the things that Tierra Nueva decided to do was to have train a number of their members in how to make these grain storage silos. And then we started a program of a loan rotating fund where small farmers could have these silos made for them, you know, by Tierra Nueva promoters. And so, you know, many, many silos, grain storage silos were built.
Daddy says he wants to say something.
Sí, una de las cosas que quería tocar usted había olvidado que en la cooperativa las tarimas donde están sentados los hilos los construyó Celio y otro amigo.
Yeah, one of the just in this silo project, the thing, all the foundation, all the wood that these silos were resting on were constructed by
and
the metal silos I built along with my other member, another companion of my ministry.
Capacitados.
We were sent by Tierra Nueva to, you know, to be trained to do that. So our whole objective after about the second year was to train promotores. And promotoras, you know, women and men promoters who could go out, and that's how the program really took off, because, I mean, we could never go from 12 to, you know, we had 2,000 families working with us at the end of our fifth year, and that was only because we trained about 35, you know, agricultural promoters and health workers, and these were people that were coming to our University of the Countryside. In fact, these women right here, this is David's wife, and right there, and then this is my wife. And then Celio's wife right here, Celio's wife, Ada. So basically the promoters were like couples in the same way that we were couples. You know, all of these people, the husband and the wife would go out together in the same way that Gracie and I would go out together. We started out going on horseback, and then we ended up having a 250 Yamaha motorcycle that we traveled around. You know, and the promoters would go on horseback. And when we left, you know, in 89, the promoters have continued since then to, you know, to visit, and, you know, Tierra Nueva has continued. It continues today, and these guys are representatives of it.
It's hard to see the lady below. There's a lady below there in the red, and then her husband with a white shirt. And there's me, and I forget who else over there. So we're going in couples, which wasn't something that you saw very often down there. Mm-hmm.
So people, now, once there were promoters in place, people could go off long distances, like Celio. Would walk 25 miles in 2 days, you know, twice a month. You know, he and his wife would walk in these little high-heeled shoes. I mean, like half a high heel, whatever you call those. You know, and she walked.
Actually, no, she wore her thongs.
He wore her thongs, plastic thongs.
Her nice shoes on as soon as she got.
And then he put her. She carried her nice shoes. Yeah. And anyway, these guys would walk. I mean, 25 miles sometimes in a day they'd walk. I mean, 25 miles one way, right? And then 25 miles back. Just incredible distances to go to these villages. And, you know, a lot of these people, I mean, you know, if they were in the States, they'd probably be on the Olympic team, you know. You know, they had no opportunity to, you know, to do that. But anyway, they're incredibly athletic folks and could do things that we could never do. And the whole objective of Tierra Nueva was to organize committees, agricultural committees. You know, the one of the philosophies of Tierra Nueva is independent but organized. Mm-hmm. You know, we really struggled with how much to get involved with the popular movement in terms of campesino organizations. But a lot of people saw campesino organizations as being co-opted by the government, because the government would give them loans if they were organized. And so the people were organizing mainly to get a loan from the government, and then they'd usually fail to pay their loan off, and then the government would take their land. So campesino organizations were kind of frowned upon in our region, you know, peasant organizations, and these guys. So we had an opportunity with them to kind of develop a new model, which was agricultural committees that were, you know, that were completely independent of any kind of government help, and that were not looking for loans, you know, but were trying to be sustain themselves from what they had right there, their own resources. So some of the committees, like this is David's, right in David's land, and this is the committee started out quite small in his village. And others were larger, you know, and this is the village where Celio's, he's from around there. And once people were organized, then they could do things like gravity flow water systems. Hardly any of the villages when we first went there in our area had gravity flow water systems. They didn't have running water. And now there's about 35 villages that have put them in, you know, through because of Tierra Nueva, you know, having these agricultural committees that were organized to. You know, then we raised the money for the pipes, you know, and then the Tierra Nueva committee would organize all the people in the village to put in the system. But the main purpose of being organized was to receive training, you know, and we would, we had so many requests after our third or fourth year. About our fourth year we were getting, you know, we would say the only way that we will come to your village is if you send us a list of at least 15 farmers that want to receive the training, and then you have to be willing to cover the costs for the, you know, you have to be able to feed and house two agricultural promoters for 5 days straight, and then for twice, to be, you have to be able to feed and house them for, you know, twice a month for their visits for a year. And so we would get these formal, you know, letters from village after village after village saying we would like a promoter to come, and, you know, so we'd send these, the promoters would go off. And then every 2 weeks they would commit to visiting, you know, from planting all the way till harvest. You know, and then year after year. So that's David and Celio visit. It's continue to visit communities. They've been doing it for the last 15 years. One of the main objectives of our ministry after about the fourth year was Bible study. And what happened was, actually it was about our third year, we were in Celio's village of San Antonio, and we were gathered under a big mango tree talking, and suddenly this guy drove up with this white pony. And he had a big six-shooter in his side, and one of the guys said, "Hey, that's Lisandro Guzman, and he's a murderer. And we're kind of worried about this guy being here in our Bible study." You know, we lived in an area where there were a lot of people that were like fugitives, you know. And they maybe they paid off a judge and gotten free, but they were living way out in the backwaters of the Department of Comayagua. But these guys needed to improve production of beans and corn too, so they'd come to our meetings. And it was that day that one of the members of the community said, "Hey, you know, Roberto, we would like to know whether whether we could do what you do and put God first in our agriculture committee. And I said, well, what do you mean what we do? And he says, well, you know, everyone knows that you guys have a Bible study in your home. And we said, oh, really? How do you know that? And I said, everyone knows you guys have a Bible study in your home. And I said, okay, well, just the four of us, you know, the four, the Catalina, our Guatemalan social worker, Fernando, myself, and Gracie. But somehow, you know, in a little village, the word travels, right? So they said that, I remember Herman, he's this, the head of this, you know, one of the members of this community, said, you know, we are so materialistic, we have campesinos. And I said, what do you mean you guys are materialistic? I looked at these guys, they were in rags, you know, with, you know, just beating up old shoes, and some of them didn't even have shoes. And I said, well, what do you mean materialistic? And they said, well, all we talk about is how are the pigs, how's the milpa, you know, how's the cornfield? He says, and we want to put God first. Is it possible for us to start every one of our agricultural committee meetings with a Bible study? I said, because we're all Catholics and we don't know anything about our Catholic faith, and maybe you could teach us how to, about the faith, and the, you know, so we can teach our kids. And besides, that might make some of the rougher members of our committee more gentle. So anyway, that's how we started our Bible studies. After 3 or 4 years, just came out of the blue. And we would, but I noticed that every time I pulled a Bible out, people had fear in their eyes, you know. There was like, it was like, they reminded me of dogs with their tail between their legs that were ready to kind of run off because they're expecting a kick, you know. Like a Honduran dog is not like an American dog. Honduran dogs are kind of used to, you know, kind of being, you know, people don't pet them and hold them and, you know, sleep with them and kind of treat them like we treat our animals, right? They're more like, when they come around, their tails are between their legs because they're expecting a kick, right? And that's how the average peasant in Central America looks when you pull out a Bible. Because they're expecting, you know, a scolding. So anyway, it was very delicate process of getting people to study the scriptures, but little by little, we developed some ways of reading. And what the main way we used is to say, you know, we would say, we're not going to talk about what we're supposed to do here, because that's what divides all the churches. You know, the Pentecostals say you have to speak in tongues and go to church every night and obey the pastor and, you know, not drink, smoke, or dance. And the Catholics say you have to get married and so you can take the sacraments, and then you have to confess and do all these things. And the Liberation Theologian Catholics say we have to get organized and, you know, and take the land and you know, love everybody and, you know, and be it for human rights. And, you know, everyone has their lists of things that divide everybody, right? So I said, well, we're not gonna talk about what we're supposed to do. We're gonna talk about what God is doing. What does God do for us through this text? What's the good news of this text? So we use that as a hermeneutical principle of interpretation, where anytime someone would say, well, we're supposed to do this, I'd say, no, we're not gonna talk about what we're supposed to do. We're gonna talk about what is God doing? And that worked, and that allowed us to work with people. And these committees had Pentecostals, Catholics, and the majority of people were people that weren't part of any church. And when we used this approach, we would see that, you know, a Catholic guy who maybe went to Mass once a year would say things that would blow away the Pentecostals who were, like, going every night to church, right? And so the Pentecostal guy would just, he'd be sitting there with his mouth hanging open, like, wow, this Catholic guy said that? And then the Pentecostals would say something that would blow away the Catholics who were like celebrators of the word. And that was a way that we were able to, you know, have some kind of ecumenical, you know, movement in our ministry, which really did continue and continues now. Now in Tierra Nueva there are Pentecostals and Catholics, and, you know, probably mostly Catholics, but it's pretty diverse. And in the last 10 years, the last 5 years, Gracie and I have become members of a spiritual fraternity in France called Les Veilleurs, which is the Watch Persons. And it's a spiritual fraternity that started in the 20s, and which is actually, some of the members were the founders of Taizé after that. And it involves a commitment to reading the scriptures morning, noon, and evening, and at noon reciting of the Beatitudes, and then a commitment to reflecting on the cross on Fridays and on the and celebrating the resurrection on Sundays. And a commitment to trying to have quarterly retreats on prayer and how do we pray, but looking at prayer from many different traditions. Like typically you'd have a Jesuit that would do something on Ignatian spirituality maybe one quarter, and then maybe you'd have a Baptist doing something on Baptist spirituality, whatever that is, you know, the next the next quarter or whatever, and then something on silence and the role of silence, or you'd have just whoever was around, or something. A Pentecostal would do something on the role of the Holy Spirit. I mean, the whole idea is of the veladores, we call it in Spanish, is for there to be it's a spiritual brotherhood, fraternity, where people come together, to encourage each other. So anyway, almost everyone in Tierra Nueva has become members of the spiritual fraternity. So now, one of the things we do is we go down on a yearly basis and we give retreats, and we organize. We try to find other people that can help give retreats, and I was down in November, December, with the head of the Leveia.
Preguntando si los químicos que el gobierno de Honduras promueve son hechos en los Estados Unidos.
Yeah, some of it's in Japan too.
So is there a closing relationship between the chemical companies and the Honduras government?
Es que hay una relación amistosa entre las compañías de químicos y el gobierno hondureño.
Sí.
How affected was that area by the hurricane, and how has recovery been for that area versus the rest?
Esta región fue muy afectada por el huracán, y si fue, ¿cómo anda ahora?
Nosotros le llamamos que estamos en un proceso de reconstrucción.
We're in the process of reconstruction, rebuilding.
Porque hay agricultores que perdieron toda su tierra.
There were farmers that lost all their land in our region.
Habemos unos que perdimos la cosecha.
There were some people that lost all their
farms. Mucha agua se nos pudrió.
There was too much rain and everything rotted.
Entonces, pero tal vez los que perdimos la cosecha sabemos que al sembrar el próximo año.
But we've lost our harvest. We know we can plant again next year.
Hay unos que perdieron la tierra.
But there were people that lost their land.
Otros que perdieron la casa.
Others that lost their home.
Porque hay lugares que no molestó la inundación.
Because there are places where
como son partes inclinadas.
Where they're very steep, and so they didn't flood it.
Los deslizamientos.
But they were.
A veces le ubicaron la casa a 200 varas abajo.
Sometimes they move a house 200 yards below where it was.
Entonces nosotros decimos que estamos en un proceso de reconstrucción.
We say that we're in the process of rebuilding and reconstruction.
Cuando lleguemos de aquí, vamos a ir a visitar una zona
montañosa
donde hay un comité organizado,
a mountainous region where there's a committee organized,
que tiene problemas.
They have problems.
Sí. Vamos a ver qué se puede hacer por ellos.
See what we can do with it.
Porque no lo dañó la inundación, pero sí los derrumbes, los deslizamientos.
But there were landslides. Well, it looks like our time is up. It's time for lunch and everything, but tomorrow we're going to be talking about obstacles to development, both in Central America and in North America, in terms of this kind of holistic liberation, whatever that we're trying to talk about. Obstacles and how to overcome the obstacles too.
Well, thanks. You can give me the present.